Everyone this evening. We finished chapter 9 in our last class, and we're going to begin this class at a really high level and take a glance at chapters 10 to 12 in very general terms and come back to chapter 10, verse 1 very quickly. We've been studying in the book of Judges, and I don't recall if we've mentioned a general timeline of these events. As you look at the timeline on the screen in very general terms, after the Exodus and the wilderness years and the partial conquest of Canaan, the people eventually turned away from God. And after time passed, that's when God appointed judges to lead the people back to God. And that period of time, in general terms, since I wasn't there, 1367 to 1043 B.C. in general terms. As we look at what our study of the book of Judges will cover, out of 14 judges, we've studied 5 so far, and in the next 3 chapters, we're going to hear the names of Tola and Jair and Jephthah and Isban and Elon and Abdon. And as we primarily study the actions of Jephthah, who is the title of this slide, notes, is an example of faith who made a tragic and disturbing vow. Judges 12:7 will tell us that he judged Israel for about 6 years. So to look at things at a very high level, in the 10th through the 12th chapters, this cycle that we've been talking about of behavior is going to be seen. In the 10th chapter, we're going to see some oppression, and then we're going to see them cry out to the Lord for help. We're going to see the beginning of deliverance going on into the 11th chapter. And in the 11th chapter, Jephthah is going to make a vow that we will discuss. And then in the 12th chapter, there's going to be some fighting. As we study this 10th chapter, there are some pretty strong words used to describe what's going on. And on the screen, I showed them to you in the 8th and 9th and 12th verses where I'll be reading New American Standard, afflicted, crushed, distressed, oppressed. None of the words that we want to hear applied to ourselves. New King James and King James use other words very similar. But these words aren't altogether unfamiliar with us, because earlier in the 2nd chapter, we saw that these people had brought things down upon them and plundered and distressed and oppressed and afflicted were words that were appropriate at that time as well. Also, just at a very high level, one author has suggested that there are a series of confrontations or conflicts that we'll be seeing in the book, with it beginning with Israel and the Lord, and then several nations, Ammon, the family of Jephthah, the elders of Gilead, an Ammonite king, the Ammonites in general. We're going to find a discussion of his daughter, and then the 12th chapter is going to have Jephthah involved with the Gileadites, and Ephraim. So that's a high-level look at where we're going. In Judges, the 10th chapter, the first 5 verses we read, "Now after Abimelech died, Tola, the son of Puah, the son of Dodo, a man of Issachar, arose to save Israel. And he lived in Shamer in the hill country of Ephraim. He judged Israel 23 years. Then he died and was buried in Shamer. After him, Jair the Gileadite arose and judged Israel 22 years. He had 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys, and they had 30 cities in the land of Gilead that are called Havoth Jair to this day. And Jair died and was buried in Canaan." The actions of Abimelech suggest Israel has reached a new low God paints another picture of apostasy pretty quickly here. And there are not going to be any major oppressors or huge battles or defined calls for a deliverer. There's also no rest mentioned. And it's going to be a time of pretty constant turmoil. As we look at these verses to begin with, Abimelech's dead. All we know about Tola basically is his lineage. He's the son of Pua, the son of Dodo, of the tribe of Issachar. We know that Issachar is in the northern part of Canaan. It's south of the Sea of Galilee. And we're going to find that he's living down in Ephraim. And Ephraim is more toward the middle, closer to the where the tribe of Dan and Judah have their grounds and tribal area. So as we look at this, while of the tribe of Issachar, Tola lived in Shamer in the hill country of Ephraim. That suggests maybe that his leadership was accepted by the tribe. And since he judged Israel for 23 years, it suggests a period of stability and helpful period of leadership for the people. Although Abimelech comes between Gideon and Tola, Tola must have been the true successor of Gideon. Perhaps one of the, there's Gilead. Perhaps one of the things that draws my attention the most here is that it says that he arose to save Israel. And in a sense, Abimelech was like the Midianites in that he was an oppressor to the people. So if Tola did some good things and brought some peace and stability, he could make things a lot better. And maybe that's one of the senses in which he judged Israel for a period of time and arose to save Israel. Then very quickly, we're done with Tola. And after him, in verse 3, we get to another judge. Jared the Gileadite arose and judged Israel 22 years. He had 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys, and they had 30 cities. You know, as you think about that, let's see, I'll leave it on that slide. As you think about that, when he serves for 22 years, it's perhaps another period of relative stability. And when you see what they tell us about him, 30 sons. I think I can read the faces of some of the ladies here. They don't want 30 children by themselves. And this seems to imply multiple wives, just as Gideon had. And because the 30 sons rode on 30 donkeys, that may be an indication of some degree of importance and wealth. And each of these sons managed a city of Gilead. The multiple marriages, polygamous marriages, the nepotism of his sons hint at maybe some weakness on his part as a judge. And when he died, he was buried in Canaan. So in the first four verses, we're meeting a couple of judges. We've gone through, 55 years of relative peace with these two judges. We don't learn a lot about them, but if after Abimelech they have a period of peace, perhaps the people were much happier than when Abimelech was trying to make his presence known. What would you like to say over these first four verses? Verse 6. Then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, served the Baals and the Ashtoreth, the gods of Aram, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the sons of Ammon, and the gods of the Philistines. Thus they forsook the Lord and did not serve him. the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the sons of Ammon. They afflicted and crushed the sons of Israel that year. For 18 years they afflicted all the sons of Israel who were beyond the Jordan in Gilead in the land of the Amorites. The sons of Ammon crossed the Jordan to fight also against Judah, Benjamin, and the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was greatly distressed. Immediately, as you read verse 6, let me ask, that we have a stark picture of Israel's unfaithfulness in verse 6. Then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. Does that sound familiar to anyone in here? The apostasy is blatant. They did evil in the sight of the Lord. It sounds familiar, and it should be, because when you look at that passage in Judges 2, verse 11, we read, the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. In the third chapter, verse 7, the sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Asherah. In the third chapter, verse 12, now the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel because they had done evil in the sight of the Lord. In the fourth chapter, then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. In the sixth chapter, then the sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord gave them into the hands of Midian 7 years. Tenth chapter, verse 6, where we are. Then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, and guess what? It's not going to end there. In the 13th chapter that we will not get to tonight or likely on Sunday. Now the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, so that the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines 40 years. Israel's pattern of activity is horrid. As we go back and look at that sixth verse, consider the detail God gives us of how many false gods Israel is worshiping. Baals and Asherah and the gods of Sidon, Moab, Ammon, and the Philistines. Now, notice, as you look at those, some of these gods belong to the historic enemies of Israel. From the northern area, they worshipped the gods of Aram and Sidon. Northern Canaan is where Aram and Sidon were. From east of the Jordan, they worshipped the gods of Moab and Ammon. To the west, they were attracted to the gods of the Philistines. So verse 6 says simply, then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. And it concludes, thus they forsook the Lord and did not serve him. Pretty stark words. And then look at verse 7. The anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the sons of Ammon. Doesn't sound like a good time. Verse 7 tells us, because of the great sin of Israel, God provides a double oppression for them. Verse 7 says, both the Philistines to the west and the Amorites to the other direction, east, were afflicting and crushing Israel. Verse 8, they afflicted and crushed the sons of Israel. That year, for 18 years, they afflicted all the sons of Israel who were beyond the Jordan and Gilead and the land of the Amorites. Verse 9 tells us at some point the Ammonites crossed the Jordan to attack the tribes of Judah, Benjamin, and Ephraim. And what we see there is that Israel was finally greatly distressed. What would you like to say through verse 9, please? Dale. If these false gods are so powerful, why aren't they taking away all the oppression? Why aren't they giving relief to Israel? So I. It's as if once those areas come in and beat up on them a while, they adopt that false god. You would think they would say, well, we don't want to have anything to do with them, but instead, they adopt them. They embrace them. Good comment. Anyone else? Kenny. Good comment. Anyone else? Verse 10. Then the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord, saying, we have sinned against you, for indeed we have forsaken our God and served the Baals. Well, how long has it taken them to finally get to this point? Anyway, verse 11. The Lord said to the sons of Israel, did I not deliver you from the Egyptians, the Amorites, the sons of Ammon, and the Philistines? Also, when the Sidonians, the Amalekites, and the Maonites oppressed you, you cried out to me, and I delivered you from their hands. Yet you have forsaken me and served other gods. Therefore, I will no longer deliver you. Go and cry out to the gods which you have chosen. Let them deliver you in the time of your distress. The sons of Israel said to the Lord, we have sinned Do to us what seems good to you, only please deliver us this day. So they put away the foreign gods from among them and served the Lord, and he could bear the misery of Israel no longer. Finally, we see in verse 10, Israel admits to two sins. They say, we've forsaken God. Yeah, pretty big time. And we've served the Baals and a lot of other false gods. And then God lists some of the times he's rescued these people from the enemies in verses 11 and 12, and says, well, we just read the list, Egyptians and Amorites and Ammon and Philistines and so on. And then he says in verse 13 that despite God's grace on multiple occasions, Israel continues to forsake the true God of heaven. He says, therefore, I will no longer deliver you. That gets their attention. And then God not only says he won't deliver them, he tells them to go ask these false gods to deliver them. Finally, we see in verses 15 and 16, the sons of Israel said to the Lord, we have sinned. Do to us whatever seems good to you. Only please deliver us this day. So they put away the foreign gods from among them and served the Lord, and he could bear the misery of Israel no longer. Confession of sin, admission of guilt, indication that they will accept whatever punishment God decrees as long as he delivers them. The added element this time is they actually put away the foreign gods. They actually begin serving God again. Verse 16 closes by saying God can bear their misery no longer. Finally, we may have a moment of sincerity out of these people after they've gone so far away from God and seen the consequences of being away from God. Let's hope that individually we don't place ourselves in that same position and move far away from the true God of heaven. And instead, when we sin, admit it and turn to God with sincerity. What would you like to say through verse 16? Did I touch the key? The devil's avenue of approach, the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life cannot come first, cannot come second, or have any place in our life. God has to come first. As we go to these next verses, I'm just going to tell you, I think verse chapter 10 and 17 fit together better than being broken apart. But in verse 17, then the sons of Ammon were summoned, and they camped in Gilead. And the sons of Israel gathered together and camped in Mizpah. The people, the leaders of Gilead, said to one another, who is the man who will begin to fight against the sons of Ammon? He shall become head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. Beginning in verse 17, the stage begins to be set for another judge to arise. The Ammonites are pushing north against the Israelites in Gilead. So the Israelites gather at Mizpah to block the advance. As we saw earlier, the map shows Gilead southeast of the Sea of Galilee. It's an area assigned to Gad. Let's see, do I have one more slide? The leaders of Gilead found that they were not qualified to lead their defense. So they decide to find themselves a ruler that can lead them into battle. Now let me change presentations very quickly. Okay, let's hope that I did. Okay, I made it. So there we are at the end of the 10th chapter. We see that those leaders of Gilead want somebody to help them. As that 10th chapter closes, the Ammonites are coming north. The enemy's coming. They want somebody to lead them. As we look at the map, I mentioned a moment ago the Sea of Galilee, and there I pointed out a little more clearly. Gilead is shown there on the map, and Ammon is down south and to the east a little bit. Here is a little bit of a larger view where you can see the Sea of Galilee, the tribal lands of Gad, and the Ammonites are coming toward Gilead. The foe is at the gates, if you will. They're attempting to take the land allocated to the tribe of Gad. So as we go into the 11th chapter, now Jephthah the Gileadite was a valiant warrior, but he was the son of a harlot, and Gilead was the father of Jephthah. Gilead's wife bore him sons, and when his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out and said to him, "You shall not have an inheritance in our father's house, for you are the son of another woman." So Jephthah fled from his brothers and lived in the land of Tob. And worthless fellows gathered themselves about Jephthah, and they went out with him. So beginning there in verse 1, we meet Jephthah, and we learn some things about him. Jephthah was from Gilead. He was known to be a great warrior. He was born the son of a harlot, which implies illegitimacy. From Deuteronomy, the 23rd chapter, verse 2, we see there are consequences for a person who is born out of wedlock. From Hebrews, the 11th chapter, verse 32, we also see that Jephthah was a person to be respected by us today. Jephthah speaks respectfully of the Lord on multiple occasions in this chapter. He attributes Israel's past victories to the Lord here in verses 21 and 23 of this chapter. He calls upon the Lord to judge between Israel and Ammon in verse 27. He received assistance from the Lord, verse 29. And then he makes a rash, unfortunate vow in verse 30. So as we meet Jephthah, I don't normally say much about what my co-teacher thinks, but he and I don't find Jephthah our favorite judge out of all of them, for some of the reasons of his behavior. But at the same time, in Hebrews, the 11th chapter, verse 32, we know he is worthy of our respect based upon his presentation there with others. So as we look at verse 2, what we're seeing here is that his biological father had multiple sons by his wife. When Jephthah's half-brothers were grown, they'd had enough. They drove him away and told him he would have no inheritance. As an outsider and an outcast, he went to a place and lived in the land of Tob. And I checked, and the location, the exact location's not known. As verse 3 closes, it seems that Jephthah was basically there when it says that he's associating with worthless fellows, gathered themselves about Jephthah, and they went out with him. It seems that he's basically an outcast leader of outlaws. The expression "they went out with him" may mean that he was leading some raids against others. But he's not in the family bosom and viewed all that favorably by his half-brothers. Comments through verse 3. So in verse 4, it came about after a while that the sons of Ammon fought against Israel. When the sons of Ammon fought against Israel, the elders of Gilead went to get Jephthah from the land of Tob. And they said to Jephthah, "Come and be our chief, that we may fight against the sons of Ammon." Then Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, "Did you not hate me and drive me from my father's house? So why have you come to me now when you're in trouble?" The elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, "For this reason we have now returned to you, that you may go with us and fight with the sons of Ammon and become head over all the inhabitants of Gilead." Now notice verse 9. So Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, "If you take me back to fight against the sons of Ammon and the Lord gives them up to me, will I become your head?" The elders of Gilead said in verse 10 to Jephthah, "The Lord is witness between us. Surely we will do as you have said." Verse 11, then Jephthah went to the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and chief over them. And Jephthah spoke all his words before the Lord at Mizpah. You know, desperate times, I guess, require desperate actions. We see the leaders in Israel, the elders of Gilead, fear the Ammonite fighters, probably with good reason. They turn to Jephthah. Remember, he's already been recognized as a strong fighter. And they ask him to be their leader. Jephthah reminds them that they consented to his expulsion from his homeland and makes them humble themselves by explaining why he should help them since he's been treated so harshly. You know, he grew up in a family environment. The older brothers got to a point where they said, "You're the son of someone else and you're not going to inherit anything from this location. You need to go away." And nobody in the city where he was living protected him, and he went out and had to go someplace else and make a life for himself. So he's saying, "Why me? Aren't you the ones that either drove me away or consented to me being driven from my home? Why should I help you?" As we read these notes, note that the leader of the people is not being designated by God. Instead, the men of the area are doing the selecting. In response to Jephthah's question, in response to Jephthah's questions, the elders say, "We need you to defend us. If you will, we'll make you our leader." So, what happens next is Jephthah there in verse 9 makes the elders repeat themselves. It in many senses I think he's making them eat humble pie. And in another sense, he's making sure they understand that they're making a commitment that they're going to have to live to. They have to take him back. That's the first point. And remember, they weren't the ones that supported him when he was thrown out. And he wants confirmation of their offer. So, if I fight the Ammonites, and secondly, the Lord gives the victory, will you make me the leader? And they pledge before the Lord to do as they've promised. We're going to stop here. Class is up. What would you like to say? We'll come back to these verses again on Sunday morning.